Welcome to Moment of Truth with Amy Chen Mills. That's me. Our show presents clear thinking on confusing topics in challenging times. Today is December 4th, 2023, and day four of the COP28, otherwise known as the Conference of the Parties, and increasingly known by some of us as the Global Climate Cop Out. This year, the president of this UN-organized annual event on climate change, Sultan Al-Jaber, is also CEO of the National Energy Company for the UAE. Indeed, the whole getup is being hosted in the United Arab Emirates, where the sale of fossil fuels, as in other Arab nations, is a predominant part of the national economy. What does this mean for the future of climate mitigation? Is there still hope for the COP? Is there still hope for the world? How has the fossil fuel industry derailed efforts to save a livable planet for humans and nearly all other species? How is that industry connected to authoritarianism worldwide? How do indigenous rights and sovereignty factor into climate mitigation? We discuss all of this and more on our program, Fueling Fascism, with our amazing guest today, Amy Westervelt. Amy, are you there?
I'm here now.
Oh, sorry. You are. We're so glad. We're so glad you could join. I am going to introduce you, and then we have tons of questions for you. We have on the line with us at KSQD, Amy Westervelt, who is an award-winning investigative print and audio journalist and founder of the podcast company Critical Frequency, specializing in narrative podcasts. Amy produced Unfinished Short Creek, named one of the best podcasts of the year by The New Yorker and The Atlantic, and received a Wilbur Award for religion reporting. In 2021, she led production of This Land S2, an investigative narrative season revealing the forces behind efforts to unravel tribal sovereignty in the U.S. via attacks on the Indian Child Welfare Act. This was nominated in 2022 for a Peabody Award. Her investigative climate podcast, Drilled, a Critical Frequency original production, was awarded the Online News Association Award for Excellence in Audio Journalism and Covering Climate Now's Award for Excellence in Audio Journalism as well. Amy has won many other prestigious awards, and her work has been featured on NPR, in The Guardian, The Economist, The Washington Post, The Atlantic, and Inside Climate News, and is often cited as amongst the earliest examples of accountability reporting on climate. Damages, a Drilled spinoff focused on climate litigation, launched in 2021, and received the Covering Climate Now Audio Award for 2022. Amy has won many more awards as a 20-year veteran investigative journalist. Westervelt's earlier work for NPR, The Washington Post, The Wall Street Journal, Inside Climate News, and various outlets earned her Edward R. Murrow, ONA, and Folio Awards as well. Before we get into this conversation with climate journalist diva, is what I call her, Amy Westervelt, I just want to remind everyone that you can call into the station if you are in the United States at 831-900-5773, 831-900-5773, or you can text that number as well if you have a comment or a question for Amy Westervelt. You can also email us at onair@ksqd.org. That's onair@ksqd.org. Welcome, Amy. How are you?
Hi, I'm good. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, you've got your library of work, your body of work is daunting to say the least. And so it's very exciting to have you on as a former climate activist myself, and I should say current climate activist, more focused now on democracy in the United States. Yeah. I wanted to start with the COP28 because it's in the news, it's happening, it's ongoing, everyone's hearing about it. And there seems to be some good things are happening, methane reduction agreements. The Environmental Defense Fund director was super excited about that. The Loss and Damage Fund for Developing Nations with actual like monetary commitments from developed nations for the first time is what I understand. But what do you think about all of this? Is this, we have, you know, this very controversial president of the COP who has also said that the science does not support a phase out of fossil fuels as necessary to stay below 1.5 degrees. And then he also said, unless we want to take the world back into caves. I'm really curious what you're thinking about all of this. Is this just a huge greenwashing extravaganza? I mean, I was surprised to hear some of the things that seem like positive developments come out of this COP. What are your thoughts about this?
Yeah, I mean, there's a few things. I think that seeing some actual money, actually seeing the financial pledges is almost less positive to me, because that has happened before. Like, you know, a lot of countries have pledged money in the past and then just not followed through with it.
Yeah.
But the thing that's promising is that they've actually, I mean, it's like, this is like the boring detail, but it sort of makes me think, okay, maybe it's real this time. But they've actually kind of set up the mechanisms for this account to exist and to be administered in some kind of way that everyone's agreeing on, and that kind of thing, which makes it seem more real. So that's good. I feel bad because I feel like every time I talk about this stuff, I'm like, you know, a little bit of good, and then here's all the pretty bad stuff.
Yeah, no, I know, I understand, you know.
But
so,
like,
you know, go for it. We need reality. I mean, we need reality.
I mean, look, the issue with loss and damage is that what's been promised is just so much less than what's actually needed. And I also, my kind of prediction going into this COP was that because of who the president is and because of where it's at, and also just because of kind of things that the industry has been saying for the last few years, I suspect that we'll see commitments to loss and damage, and we'll see a big focus on phasing out coal, because these are things that make the COP look good without ever having to talk about phasing out oil and gas, which are the real big problems, which is not to say that it's not good to fund loss and damage or that it's not good to focus on phasing out coal, just that if those things are used as sort of a distraction from really, you know, what everyone kind of agrees needs to be the focal point at this COP, which is phasing out oil and gas, then it's not even so much greenwashing, I guess, as just sort of distraction or delay on the thing that's that most needs to get done.
Well, let's talk about the statement from the COP president, Al Jabir, who is himself the head of a fossil fuel industry, you know, energy company, you know, which is crazy. But he basically said science does not support a phase out of fossil fuels as necessary to stay below 1.5 degrees. I hope I got that right. I think that's what he said.
This is so interesting, right? Because this is what the headline of the Guardian story says that he said in this tape. But if you listen to the tape, it's not exactly what he said. What he said was that he says the science, and he sort of corrects himself and says there are no scenarios. And what he's talking about there are the scenarios that are drawn out in the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, the IPCC reports that come out every few years and sort of give us a summary of the climate science as it stands, and talk about, you know, the reality of the situation and what might be done and all those kinds of things. And it's true that the IPCC scenarios all include some form of what Al Jaber refers to as abatement, which is like carbon capture or, you know, sequestration or all these other kinds of things that like would technically let you not have an absolute phase out of fossil fuels. That's like a very, very wonky detail, but this guy says enough wild stuff that, you know, I'm like, okay, let's engage with what he did say. Like, to me, the thing about the going back to caves is way more disconcerting, because it's such a talking point of the industry right now, this idea that people who are pushing for an energy transition are condemning, you know, the world's poor to like starve and freeze in the dark. That's really like the framing that we've been seeing the last couple of years. And he's really doubling down on that in this this tape, which I should clarify, is like this was an interview that he was doing with Mary Robinson, who's the former president of Ireland and a big climate advocate. And like, I don't know if you've I highly recommend that you listen to it, because just the way he speaks to her is really interesting to listen to. And some of the stuff that he says in there, it's like a, you know, 5-minute primer on like every PR message the fossil fuel industry has been putting out in the last 20 years.
And that's something that you've covered quite a bit in your podcast, I think both Drilled and Rigged.
Yes.
For people who want to catch up with some of that. But it has been pretty horrifying, you know, in my own research to learn about Heartland Institute, which I call the Heartless Institute, you know, and how much propaganda there's been. And you said something that I'm wondering if you could clarify for our listeners about if we have carbon capture, quote unquote, technologies, I suppose they mean other than trees, right? I was also, I was seeing Al Gore say something about, look, this is all just research. Like there's nothing really out there
that's true.
Okay, so when you...
Okay, so the reality is, like, there are carbon capture projects that are up and running today. However, they are very, very small. None of them work on, you know, like, I feel like the way that this gets talked about by a lot of fossil fuel executives, and I would include Al Jaber in that group, is like... like we have some magical vacuum that's just sucking up all the CO2 from the skies. That's not at all like what we're talking about here. There are some technologies where you're attaching, you know, carbon capture equipment to, you know, a smokestack and getting, and, you know, capturing carbon right at the source in very like concentrated applications. But the big problem is, how do we get it when it's already dispersed out into the atmosphere? And that's very much still in the research phase. And then on top of that, the stuff that does exist, it's like 80% of it is being used for what's called enhanced oil recovery, where they take the compressed carbon, they inject it underground, and they use that to get more oil out. So like, if your carbon capture project is in service of developing more oil, how does that count as abating greenhouse gas emissions?
Yeah.
I'm not sure how the math is mathing on that one. You know, I don't get it. So yeah, there's a lot of that going on. This word too, abated, you know, both Al Jaber and all the sort of fossil fuel folks are really into this language that's very, you know, wonky and vague about abated versus unabated emissions. And really what they're talking about is using, you know, this idea of carbon capture and in some cases hydrogen or even carbon offsets to not count certain greenhouse gas emissions. But both because of the way the technology is so far and because there's just no real auditing of the claims that companies make about how much emissions they're actually, you know, sequestering in these projects. It's ridiculous to think that, you know, that could really play into what countries are going to commit to at COP on emissions reductions.
So let's talk about the methane then, because I was listening to the, I believe, director of the Environmental Defense Fund. He was going on and on. He was so excited. He was like, this is going to bring temperatures down significantly. It's like the most significant thing that's happened in a long time. And Amy, so let's talk about these methane reduction agreements that the Environmental Defense Fund director was so excited about. His name is escaping me at the moment.
Fred Krupp.
Okay. He was all excited. And so methane is like 80 times more heating than carbon dioxide. So that's kind of exciting, I guess. And he said that there would be a way to track this and that these oil companies are... 40% of them are agreeing to be tracked in terms of their methane leaking and so on. Do you think that this is, I mean, is it a good, I guess it's a good thing, but how good is it, you know, in the big picture?
Yeah, I mean, again, it's sort of, you know, it's a step in the right direction. But even the, you know, the UN itself is saying that this is a very sort of, eyebrow raising commitment. So, you know, yes, if fossil fuel companies and, you know, the governments in which a lot of these companies are operating are genuinely going to implement methane tracking and all of the various technologies required to reduce methane emissions and all that, that's great. What we're seeing so far is pretty vague. For the majority of the past 20 or so years, the industry has, I mean, they've been committing to this. The problem is that, like with everything else, their big commitment is to self-regulate on methane, which, like, I don't know, we've seen them doing that for the last 40 years and it hasn't gone that great. So, yeah. And I mean, there's been so many reports the last few years alone. It's like every time a report comes out where satellite data is used to look at what the actual methane emissions are versus what the industry claims, it's like 10x minimum times what the industry claims. So, which again is not to say, you know, hopefully this will turn into something real. Hopefully we will get on top of methane, because the thing that's really important about methane, on top of the fact that it's, you know, 80 times more potent than CO2, is that it's really short-lived. So if we can get on top of methane, it kind of buys us some time,
yeah,
to get to decarbonization, which is actually a lot harder. The other thing I think is good for people to remember about methane is, like, the way that the industry talks about it and a lot of politicians too is this language, right, of like methane leaks, like, oops, there's just all these little tiny cracks in the pipelines that we're going to fix and it's going to be fine. That's not what we're talking about here. I don't know what PR whiz came up with methane leaks, but they're a genius. You know, what we're talking about is the intentional burning off of gas, what's called venting into the atmosphere, which happens as a regular course of operation in every gas project out there. So this is like a major kind of part of how the industry does business that needs to change. It's not this, you know, easy, simple fix, nor is it an accident that, you know, the way that the industry likes to portray it as, like, oh, you know, there are all these accidental leaks happening. You know, I think, again, to me, that says this is not the industry that you allow to self-regulate on this issue.
Yeah, they haven't done a very good job so far. Not only have they not self-regulated, they've actually actively pursued all kinds of measures and propaganda, as you've reported on, you call it petroganda, to actually stop any meaningful, you know, action on climate mitigation, on carbon dioxide emissions, and so on and so forth. We are talking with Amy Westervelt, a climate journalist and podcaster of many, many years now, about the COP28 happening right now in the United Arab Emirates. And but there's so much more to your work than just talking about the COP. And I mean, one of the pieces of information that I bring to the table with you is that I've looked at all the climate science, and honestly, when people say things like, oh, it's, you know, we don't need to phase out fossil fuels so quickly to stay below 1.5 degrees, like, I'm looking at science that's saying we're well on our way to 2 degrees or 3 degrees,
yeah.
You know, like, there's, yeah, no, we are just so far gone because of all these feedback loops that happen. You know, methane starts getting released from the Arctic, you know, the oceans can turn and start releasing carbon dioxide instead of absorb. I mean, there are just so many huge, huge factors, and I'm sure you know all of them. And I'm wondering if you could talk about, this is going to be a challenging question for you, Amy, but I thought, because you know so much, I want to get your sort of, like, what is, if you were to talk your story about climate, and if you were to sit down and, you know, I know we don't want to talk to young children about this necessarily, but if you were to tell a children's story about when we started discovering that the climate was changing and how the fossil fuel industry responded, because this has, yeah, been the bulk of your work, how could you summarize that for our audience?
Yeah, actually, this is not a hard question for me, because I think about it in exactly this way all the time. There's like, as like, basically for me, it boils down to the most basic story that you do tell, you know, like, really little kids, sort of the first story that we all learn, which is about fairness. You know, like, that kid got that toy and I didn't. That's not fair. Because really, that's what we're talking about here. We're talking about a pretty small, pretty specific group of people who had a very good understanding of what was going on and made decisions for the rest of us that included keeping that information from most people. So, you know, whenever I talk to people about this, I always think about I did a story maybe, I don't know, 7 or so years ago now, actually in the Bay Area, and up and down the West Coast, when there were all these issues that the crab fishermen were having. And one of the fishing industry trade groups actually filed a climate case against the top oil companies. And I went, you know, out on a bunch of boats and talked to people, and actually a pretty significant number of the people that were involved in the case were, I guess what we would call quote unquote climate deniers. You know, they were like, I don't necessarily believe that we're contributing to this, and, you know, had kind of all of the talking points, but yet had signed on to this lawsuit that was suing oil companies over climate change. And I was like, this is really interesting. How did this happen? And they told me that they had been shown patent applications that, you know, Exxon and Chevron and all these companies had taken out in, you know, the late 70s to mid 80s that were all about kind of preparing their business for climate change. So it was like, you know, designs for an oil tanker that could navigate a melting Arctic, or offshore oil platforms that were engineered to deal with sea level rise and these kinds of things. And so they said, you know, it doesn't matter what's causing it. Even if it's just a natural occurrence, they knew it was going to have all these really negative impacts on their business, and they prepared for it, and they didn't give us the opportunity to do that. And that's not fair. I was like, whoa.
Interesting.
That's so interesting. Yeah. And I was like, you know, you're right. It's a real basic story of fairness. Like, we don't need people to understand atmospheric science or to have to like reject, you know, their group identity by saying, actually, I do believe in climate science now, you know, which I think people do struggle with. We can talk to people in like pretty straightforward terms about, you know, everyone having access to the same information, a level playing field, everyone being able to make decisions from the same place. And getting at that stuff would actually solve a lot of the things that are blocking us on climate action. Like you said before, it's again kind of securing real democracy.
Yeah, I mean, there have been a lot of reports. I believe ExxonMobil had reports from way back that their own scientists had come up with, saying, yes, this is real. Yes, it's caused by carbon dioxide. Yes, it's caused by our industry. And so we better prepare. Of course, none of that was released. And that was before they began a campaign of, you know, sort of like denying, you know, using, I believe, some of the same consultants from the tobacco industry that were denying that, you know, cigarettes cause lung cancer. And, you know, so, yeah, there's that. There's also a Chase Bank report, you know, that's like about climate change. And Chase Bank is one of the number one funders. And that's been like released by, you know, people in the UK, where Chase Bank is saying this is like going to be disastrous. But at the same time, they're saying, but because of jobs, we're not going to be able to actually do anything about it. I'm like, it's just such a such a weird crisis that we're in, where we like have to keep going in this economy that's going to fall apart because of the climate crisis.
I know. It's so interesting when that gets used as like the reason that we can't act. Or like I talk to people a lot who are like, well, but you know, what about poor people in less developed countries that don't have access to energy yet? Like, do you want to deny them access to energy? And I'm like, okay, but if we're going to, you know, let's talk about that, but let's also talk about those very same people being the highest at risk for extreme weather events. Or can we talk about what you're going to do when those same people have to migrate? Or like, you know, it's like, if you want to talk about how all these things affect poor people, marginalized people, I'm happy to have that conversation, but like, let's have all of it, not just the piece that lets you keep making money off fossil fuels.
Yeah. And one of the things that you've been reporting on most recently is, I believe, is the curtailing of protesting and free speech and activism. And we're going to have to take a break at the half hour mark. But if you could just sort of start with like, where are you seeing this the most? And what does that look like right now? Because it's I've seen it in the UK. They increase penalties for climate protesters. You can go to prison now for many years for doing climate activism. What are you what are you seeing in your research and your reporting?
It's so interesting and really scary because I think the tendency in, you know, global North countries like the US, UK, Canada, Europe, all these countries is to think like, oh, you know, really repressive tactics against activism and free speech is something that happens in like dictatorships and, you know, authoritarian states. But actually what I'm seeing is that in the US and the UK, they're using much more repressive tactics much more quickly and really mobilizing in a pretty scary way. The UK thing that really scares me is that it's bled into what people are allowed to say in their own defense in court. So, you know, it kind of depends on whether the judge, you know, kind of adheres to the letter of the law on this, and they don't always, but if they do, then climate activists are not allowed to explain why they were protesting.
Oh my gosh.
You know, what I mean, and you know, okay, if you don't care about, you think climate activists are annoying, you don't care about that, that, you know, that's your opinion, fine. Anytime you start to curtail how people can defend themselves in court, that's a real slippery slope.
Yeah. You know?
So yeah, that's, again, I'm kind of like, okay, well, I think this is something that anyone should be concerned about, whether climate is their issue or not.
Yeah, we are talking to Amy Westervelt, who is an award-winning climate journalist and podcaster. She runs a podcast organization called Critical Frequency. She has a wealth of knowledge on the climate crisis. We will be right back with you after this short break. Today, we are talking to award-winning climate journalist and podcaster Amy Westervelt. And we were just talking about, we covered the COP28, which is happening now. We might get back to it. There's so much that I want to talk to you about, but the title of the show is called Fueling Fascism. And we were talking about sort of like the authoritarian measures that we're starting to see, including in the United States with, you know, I think it was in Florida or one, there's one state, at least one, that is saying you can now hit a protester like with your car and not be prosecuted for that. And I also wanted to talk to you because I felt like, oh, Amy Westervelt would know this, which is, you know, when Trump was elected, and I started looking into Russia and Putin and pipelines going through Syria, you know, like the pressure from the fossil fuel industry. It feels like there's a sort of like, I mean, I never really believed in evil until like in the last 7 years. Right. But like the evil empire is what comes to mind for me. Like what these people, there's a meme out there that says, it goes like this. Isn't it wild that some of us are like, let's save the planet, and others of us are like, no. You know? And just, that's sort of how I see it. It's like, really? I mean, really? Like, we're going to just all die? Is that, I mean, is that what you want? Like, because that's what will happen, you know? When we're talking about Russia, Saudi Arabia, you know, the Gulf states and also, you know, states in Latin America that are mostly, you know, they're very petroleum based. And what's happened in this country, for example, and the rise of Bannon and Trump and fascist governments in Italy and so on, you know, like, what are you seeing? I mean, I see a connection with Russia for sure, and Saudi Arabia and the United States funding, mm-hmm. you know, MAGA and Jared Kushner and so forth. Can you say that pretty unequivocally now that the fossil fuel industry is supporting these authoritarian right-wing regimes?
Yes. Okay. They tend to, I mean, they tend to fare better in those kinds of states. I mean, it's complicated like everything, but yeah, I mean, in a lot of cases, you know, I mean, even in, you know, quote unquote democracies where we're seeing like in the United States, for example, and in the UK, these laws that are criminalizing protest. In both the US and the UK, those laws were written by fossil fuel funded entities. So yeah. In the US, it was the American Fuel and Petrochemical Manufacturers, which is an industry trade group that represents, you know, the pipeline companies and the refineries. It's heavily kind of dominated by the Koch family and their various interests. But yeah, they wrote sample legislation, then they got it adopted by the American Legislative Exchange Council, which is this sort of like,
yeah, ALEC.
Bill Mill ALEC, yeah, that is also a Koch entity, and through that got it pushed to, I mean, it's almost half of US states now have those bills, those laws on the books. And you know, it's not like trespassing or vandalism were not already illegal. These are new laws that are specifically, you know, tied to a backlash to Standing Rock, which, you know, the folks who wrote the legislation have said out loud in many places. So it's not like mysterious. You know, in the UK, it's a fossil fuel funded think tank called Policy Exchange that the Prime Minister publicly thanked for helping to draft this legislation. So like even in, you know, in democratic countries, they are engaging in and you know, sort of pushing for authoritarian kind of action. I think like the thing that always strikes me when I'm thinking about this and like the way that these companies operate is that they're more powerful than any one government.
Yeah.
And I think that's what we're seeing with COP too. You know, it's in an ideal world, COP would be the thing.
Oops, we just lost Amy Westervelt, climate journalist and podcaster. And we are not sure why, but we are working very hard to get her right back on.
Happening.
Oh, there you
Oops.
Are.
There
we
I am.
Just
Sorry.
Lost a little piece of what you were saying about the COP and the fossil fuel industries
yeah.
being more powerful than any individual nation.
Yeah, there's this great book that was written by a guy named Steve Call, who's a journalist. I think he works for The New Yorker, amongst other folks. But he wrote this book called Private Empire that was about ExxonMobil, but really could have been about any oil company because they all are like really fit that that descriptor. You know, they're empires and they have so much influence over multiple governments that they have a lot more power than any one of them. And you know, something like COP should be kind of a way to deal with that because you could get multiple governments, you know, joining forces to deal with this. But unfortunately, that's not what's happened.
Yeah.
You know? Yeah. The thing I always think about too is the whole like investor state dispute system where I don't know if like you've looked into this, but
no.
it's depressing because basically most bilateral treaties, multilateral treaties, and a lot of fossil fuel contracts too, they bind governments to what's called this investor state dispute system. And it basically means that if an investor company decides that something you've done as a government has made their investment worth less money. So passing an environmental law, for example, or a human rights law, they can file an investor state dispute claim. And that claim gets heard by a tribunal of three people who are not judges. They're sort of like corporate lawyers. One of them is selected by the company itself. These proceedings happen usually in closed door tribunals. And these three people decide whether or not this government owes this company money because they changed the context for them in some way. What we're seeing a lot is that when governments try to act on climate, this is like the best kind of, you know, stopgap for fossil fuel companies. Is like when everything else fails, when suppressing protest doesn't work and lobbying doesn't work and the PR stuff doesn't work, they still have this option where they can financially punish governments for acting. So like when Biden canceled the Keystone XL pipeline permit.
Yeah.
That company, a Canadian company, filed a claim. They are currently claiming that the United States government owes them $10 billion for lost profits from that pipeline. Now, if you're the United States, you know, $10 billion is $10 billion. It's a lot of money, but at yeah. least if you're the U.S., it's not going to, you know, destroy your economy. If you're El Salvador, it might. And like,
well, wait, so what is yes. this? How is this set up? This is part of the trade agreements or?
Yes.
Okay.
It's all part of trade agreements. And
right.
it's administered by the WTO. And yeah, it's sort of it like it's this really. Again, I'm like, I don't think we've really come to grips with just how much these companies act outside of any one government's laws or policies. And that is very scary, especially given the fact that they tend to really like authoritarianism and that they have this whole system, right, that really kind of lets them get around the sovereignty of governments. It has a huge chilling effect on governments in terms of doing anything about, you know, fossil fuel dominance in their country too, because I think it's like 60% of these get found in favor of the company. So, you know, if you're a small country with a relatively small GDP, are you going to take on the risk that like a Chevron or an Exxon is going to come after you for billions of dollars? Probably
right.
not. You know,
right. Although we've seen yeah. these successes, so that we
yes.
can add a little bit of positivity here.
Yes.
I believe in Ecuador yes. and in Panama, there have been some successes in pushing back on the copper mining, for example.
Yeah, the Panama thing was really interesting. Oh, I should say too, the one I think like unequivocally good news out of COP so far
yeah.
is Colombia signing on to the new fossil fuel non-proliferation treaty.
Okay,
that's huge.
Okay,
they are like one of they're the first country that has significant coal and gas that has signed on to that. So that's a really big deal. Because so far it's mostly been countries that don't have a lot to lose necessarily on the economic front when it comes to oil and gas that have signed that. So that's a really big deal.
We are talking to Amy Westervelt, who is an award-winning and amazing podcaster and journalist, particularly on climate. She also talks about indigenous issues, including the Indian Child Welfare Act and the genocide that happened to indigenous people in this country. And we are talking with her right now on KSQD 90.7 FM, 89.7 and 89.5 FM in the California Monterey Bay Area. I just want to remind listeners that you can call us at 831-900-5773 or text to that number if you have a comment or a question, or you can email us at onair@ksqd.org. Now, I want to go to one of your most recent Instagram posts. Speaking of colonialism and genocide, you know, this is going to be it's a hot topic here in our community. You called the war in Gaza, between Israel and Gaza, a genocide. People have called it that. People have called it an ethnic cleansing. People have called it self-defense, right? What we
right.
do know is that huge amounts of buildings have come down. Like, it's almost 50%, I think, of the total area there.
Yeah.
Half of the population has been displaced. And then you talked about how, you know, this is also a climate issue. And I'm wondering if you could speak to that And also, if you see any connections between the work you've done on Indigenous issues and what's happening, how you see this.
I mean, it's a really, obviously, this is like the understatement of the year. It's a very contentious issue because, especially, you know, when you're talking about Indigenous people, people will say, well, actually, you know, people argue about who is and isn't Indigenous to that area as well, right? And who has the most claim over this land. And I think, you know, that's what the fighting has been going on about for decades now. I think that it's becoming increasingly difficult to call what's happening self-defense. And I'm not saying that to justify anything that Hamas has done, but just the sheer volume of what's happening in Gaza, it's hard to see that as self-defense. And you know, it just continues to keep going. In terms of it being a climate issue, there's a few really interesting things that have been going on there. There are gas reserves off the coast of Gaza that have been definitely in contention for quite a while. That's a big part of what the fighting has been about. There are water issues, there are land issues, not just in terms of land rights, but in terms of, you know, what's happening on that land and what's happening with agriculture in the region and all those kinds of things. And then I think also it's pretty tough to, you know, it's pretty tough for people to fight for climate or, you know, basic environmental issues if they are also feeling like they have to struggle to survive. And I think that that applies to lots of folks in that region. So I think anytime there's war happening, you're not going to see a lot of activism, that's for sure. But also, you know, military actions are amongst the most fossil fuel intensive things that we do. Wars generate more emissions than pretty much anything else we do, you know?
Yeah.
So I think if you care about climate and you're concerned about emissions, then, you know, you kind of have to want to see the end of wars, no matter how you feel about, you know, who's in them and who you feel more aligned to and those kinds of things. I think that war in general is not compatible with a livable planet, period. Yeah.
And living in general.
Yeah, life that in too. General.
Yeah.
Basic so, living.
Yeah. We're going to talk a little bit about some solutions. I know that it's it gets depressing to talk about the problem. We have a little clip from one of your podcasts, Damages, that you, I believe, co-produced. And this is episode one, and it's about the rights of nature. We're going to play that right now.
The idea behind rights of nature is that nature, trees and rivers and swamps and wild rice, could have rights and therefore legal standing. And if nature has rights, then humans can help to protect and defend those rights. On the surface, this strategy might seem like a radical idea, but it's been around for decades, actually, and in recent years, it's begun to have a real impact on how a lot of people understand nature and our relationship to it. Not just culturally, but in powerful legal ways, too.
That was an episode from the podcast Damages about the rights of nature. And that's a series. I think there are maybe two more episodes that have yet to come out. I'm not sure. That's what I was seeing on the website. And this is happening in Minnesota with wild rice being a protected legal entity. And I think people have heard about these different cases around the world. Where are we at with that now? Because, you know, there are two things that occur to me. One is that we're using the court system now because we can't find relief anywhere else, including at the COPs, right, through the UN or through trying to restrain the fossil fuel industry. But also there's indigenous values seem to be tied into kind of where we need to go. And I think you've covered that quite a bit. If you want to comment on either of those, the legal route, or even just promoting Indigenous sovereignty and Indigenous ideas and Indigenous in land back, for example.
Yeah, I think that, first of all, I think rights of nature is actually one of these things that gives me a little bit of optimism, because I think it does this thing that I don't see a lot of other proposed climate solutions doing, which is completely changes our decision-making framework. And I think this ties into Indigenous values too. It places another goal and another value at the center of how we make decisions. So like, for example, in Ecuador, which was the first country to integrate rights of nature into its constitution, they only just got around last year, I think, to the Supreme Court there, the Constitutional Court, hearing its first big rights of nature case. And it was about a mine that was actually connected to electrification. And so the president was sort of using that to say, like, oh, why are people fighting this? Because it's going to go towards electrification. And I thought that's what you guys wanted and those kinds of things. But because the decision is being made about, you know, the impact on water and biodiversity and the economy, and, you know, it kind of takes into account like everything that the community needs to survive, the entire ecosystem, you don't end up with these sort of like bad substitutions of things. You don't end up with a really polluting lithium mine replacing a coal mine, for example, and calling that a win, which I think we could do in the current system pretty easily. So, so it really is like, look, we as a community are reliant on this ecosystem, and we're going to work together as a community to protect the ecosystem that we're all a part of, so that we can continue to live in this place sustainably.
What a concept.
When people first hear it, sometimes they have like a that's weird, or it's really new agey or whatever. And you know, the sort of cliche response is like, so what, like the trees will have rights? And I just, it's interesting to me that that seems so odd to people when we've given corporations, which are not living things at all, at this point, I would say more rights than individual humans in the U.S., you know?
Yeah, when they have the right to damage the ecology so much that we can no longer live, or that we're dying of cancer.
For the benefit of one company, you know, which that seems like a major miscarriage of justice, certainly to anyone living in that community, right? So, but the thing I like about rights of nature too is that it seems to, even though it sounds like this hippy-dippy, you know, maybe like lefty concept, it tends to actually appeal to lots of people who are of the more kind of conservative libertarian mindset too, because it's generally gives, you know, people who are kind of living in the community more control. There's a lot about it that helps to protect property rights. So like, you actually started to see this a bunch in Pennsylvania and Ohio around the fracking stuff. There are communities in those states, in pretty conservative parts of those states, where people have moved to incorporate rights of nature into their town charter, because they've realized, like, wait a minute, if my neighbor says yes to this and I don't, then my property, my water still gets ruined, even though I'm not being compensated for it. That's not fair. Again, this like fairness thing.
Yeah. You know? Yeah.
I find it really interesting. And I do think that it is, I mean, it's, I don't know, whenever I talk to Indigenous people about this too, I'm all also sort of cognizant of the fact that it's very much this thing of like,
you know, sort of trampling on rights and taking land and resources and ruining them for 100 years, and then turning to these people and going, can you please solve this now? Thank you.
Right.
We'll get there someday.
Well, and people have been very gracious. I mean, we have the Amamutsin Tribal Band in our area, and they come, they can't even afford to live in our area, but they come here and they steward the land. Yeah. And they're very patient about the whole situation. I mean, there's so much injustice around, you know, their history here. But they come and they tend the grasslands, and they do controlled and cultural burns, and they, you know, and it's, and they're like, this is our job. Like, this is what, this is what our mandate is as a people, you know? And I'm like, gosh, I wish we could all just start to think that way. And maybe now is the time to actually reimburse these people for their losses and figure out, you know, land that can be given back, you know? And, and I think that is happening, and you've covered it. We're almost getting to the top of the hour, but I also wanted to talk about your company, your podcast company called Critical Frequency, and that's at criticalfrequency.org. And that is a women-led company. And that's another thing I think about is there something about women? Why did you choose to make that a women-led company? And do you find also, as with perhaps Indigenous people, that there's a different sentiment or sensibility that women carry, or and I know men can carry it too, but your thoughts about that as we get to the top of the hour?
I think, well, I mean, for me, I just, you know, I had worked in media for a long time, and I sort of saw the podcasting industry going in the same direction that I'd seen a lot of other areas of media go, which was kind of consolidation of ownership into the hands of like a few people who were almost exclusively men from the same demographic. And I thought, well, that's going to be limiting in terms of the stories that we get to hear. I wanted to, as much as I could, just sort of hold space for people that didn't fit into that demographic. And I think, I don't know, to me, I also feel like it's not, it's sort of always about the stories that I think I'm most interested in, and that I think people need to hear that they're not hearing too. So it's often like, you know, telling stories from Indigenous people and women and other marginalized groups, not just because I'm, you know, trying to promote diversity or any of these things. Although, of course, I think those things are important. But honestly, I think it's really important that we get those perspectives into conversations about big, complicated issues, because most of the conversation has been dominated by pretty narrow viewpoints for a long time, and I don't think that's gotten us anywhere.
Yeah, we're talking to Amy Westervelt, the award-winning climate journalist and podcaster. And Amy, we're going to have to go because we're at the top of the hour. We've got someone else coming into the studio. I want to thank you so much. I literally have a page more of questions for you. So maybe we can get you on again for a part two.
Yeah, and I'd be happy to. It was so great to talk to you. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, and so please check out Amy's podcast at criticalfrequency.org, Drilled, Rigged, Damages, and so much more. Actually, our next Moment of Truth live broadcast is Monday, December 18th on Reimagining Jesus. We will be speaking with one current and one former Christian pastor, both of whom now boldly critique the evangelical church for its stances on LGBTQ plus rights and more. Just in time for the holidays, what would Jesus really think and do? With author Nathan Monk and major social media influencer Mike Mashiro. Please contact the Moment of Truth team at Amy, A-M-I, at ksqd.org with questions or comments about our program. Amy's coaching and education website is at www.amychen, that's A-M-I-C-H-E-N.com. Moment of Truth gives many thanks to our team, Nyanko Nyasu, sound and tech engineer, and our research and production team, Nyanko, Mayling Obanada, Todd Zimmerman, and Vara Ramakrishnan. Todd Zimmerman of Nativerse Studios created the theme song. Kathy Krizik created our logo. Thanks to our KSQD program manager, Howard Feldstein, and the entire KSQD team on the California Central Coast, where the show originates. Thank you for thank you for tuning in to Moment of Truth. And remember, if we don't use our democracy, we lose our democracy.